5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
On the night of June 17, 1982, 20-year-old Kelly Berg Dove agreed to cover the overnight shift at the Imperial Gas Station in Harrisonburg, Virginia. She wasn't supposed to be working, but one of her sisters asked if she could switch, and Kelly said yes. In the early morning hours of June 18th, Kelly called 911 three times, reporting that a man had been harassing her and making obscene calls from a payphone outside. Her final words to the dispatcher were urgent and terrified. "Please hurry, he's back." When police arrived just 1 minute later, Kelly was gone. More than four decades have passed, and Kelly has never been found. Her family is still waiting for answers and still holding on to the hope that someone somewhere knows what happened to Kelly Berg Dove. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. Okay, a couple quick things. I did a YouTube Live last night, and some people had asked about Detective Perspective merch. We do have it. If you go to officialderek.com, we do have a Detective Perspective t-shirt out right now. It's in black. We have other things in the works down the road. I've been more focused on the cases, but if you want to rock something right now, that's where you got to go to get it. It's a pretty cool shirt. I got a few of them. Wear them to the gym all the time. If you like it, go check it out. We have them in stock right now. Why was I doing the YouTube Live? That's the really important question here. Well, if you're on audio, this isn't going to mean much to you, but if you're watching on YouTube, we just passed 100,000 subscribers last night, and this is a big deal. We are going against the grain when it comes to true crime. We are solely covering unsolved cases. I've said it before, I'll say it again tonight. In my experience, whether it's on podcasts or on television, unsolved cases are hard because a lot of people who consume true crime for, you know, obvious reasons don't love the unresolved cases. It's tough for them. They don't want to leave the episode upset. And when it's over and you have more questions than answers, it can be discouraging and it could cause you not to come back to those types of cases in the future. So when I started Detective Perspective, I knew we were going to have an uphill battle covering cases where they were missing or unsolved. It was going to be hard because there's so much content to consume out there, and I truly didn't know what was going to happen. I believe we started with around 9,000 subscribers on YouTube because I had started this channel before I got into podcasting and then just used it for Detective Perspective. But to have over 100,000 subscribers now in a little over a year and a half, it's a big deal. And I said it on the live last night. I'll say it here again. I would not be here without you. And I know that's a cliche phrase to say, but when it comes to YouTube and more specifically subscribers, that's really the only reason. I can make these cases every single day. I can do them to the best of my ability. But if you don't watch and you don't hit that little subscribe button, I don't get to 100,000 subscribers. It's that simple. So thank you so much for all the support for not only me, but for the victims and their families of these cases. That's what I want to do. I want to continue to do that. And I will tell you, I am starting to see a shift in true crime. I actually recently recorded a project, filmed a new project that relates to missing people. That's all I can really say. And it's going to be on a larger platform. And I truly believe that I was discovered or enlisted to do this program, to do this show because of you guys, because what we're doing here. So again, thank you, thank you, thank you. It means the world to me to have you guys come back every single week. I was just talking to Haley, our researcher, about this, and she was saying how on other podcasts, not everyone will consume the missing person cases because that's not what they want to see. But on Detective Perspective, whether it's a missing person or an unsolved homicide, you guys come back week after week, and I can't thank you enough. That's the last time I'll say it. And I don't want to leave my audio listeners out because I will say, although there's not a metric like subscribers to go off of, I am seeing that the listens are slowly going up week after week as well. So continue to watch, continue to listen, continue to share these stories, and hopefully together we can make a difference. So that out of the way, let's talk about why we're here tonight, Kelly Dove. I'm not going to spend too much time on the open. This is what I'll say. Yes, it's an unsolved case. Yes, it's a missing person. What's different about tonight's case is that the family and potentially law enforcement believe they not only know who's responsible, but even, yes, after 40 years, he's still alive. So with that out of the way, let's not waste any more time. Let's dive into this week's case. Kelly Jean Berg was born on August 30th, 1961 in Virginia to her parents, Rachel and Ernest. Her younger sister, Elaine, described her as, quote, a fun and happy young woman, someone who was, quote, scrappy when she needed to be. She never backed down from a challenge and would stand up for what she thought was right. When Kelly was young, her parents separated, and a few years later, Rachel met Fred Berg, and the two married in 1971. Fred adopted Kelly and her four siblings, and according to Elaine, the kids thought of him as their dad. So when I refer to Kelly's father, I'm talking about Fred. In 1975, the family moved to a quiet town in Bridgewater, Virginia, hoping for a more peaceful life. They believed it was the perfect place to raise a family, and for a while, it was. Kelly attended high school in Bridgewater, and while she was there, she was introduced to a young construction worker named Dale Dove. He was 5 years older than her, but despite the age gap, the two quickly fell in love. Not long after they started dating, Kelly became pregnant. Fred was upset when he found out, but Dale promised that he would marry Kelly and take care of both her and the baby. Fred agreed to the marriage on one condition: Kelly had to finish high school. Dale promised he would make sure that happened. On July 9th, 1977, Kelly and Dale got married, and that's when she became Kelly Berg Dove. They moved into an apartment about 20 minutes from her parents' house, and in December of that year, their daughter Tammy was born. According to Elaine, even though Kelly was young, she was genuinely excited to become a mother, and from the very beginning, she doted on Tammy. While navigating life as a young mother, Kelly actually managed to finish high school early. She would go to class and then come home and take care of her baby. She didn't socialize. She stayed focused on school and family. That was her only priorities. After graduating early, Kelly took a job at the Imperial Gas Station at 2141 South Main Street in Harrisonburg, Virginia, which is near Bridgewater. The station sat on a relatively isolated stretch of road about a mile from James Madison University. And it was really kind of a family affair. Kelly's oldest sister, Debbie, was actually the manager of the store, and two of their other sisters worked there as well. On the night of June 17, 1982, 20-year-old Kelly wasn't scheduled to work, but one of her sisters asked her to switch shifts, and Kelly agreed to cover the overnight, working from late on the 17th into the early morning hours on June 18th. And it wasn't unusual for the sisters to work the overnight shift at the gas station, but according to Elaine, Kelly typically worked during the day. That was kind of her shift. But she agreed to do it for her sister, so that night Dale dropped Kelly off at work at around 10 p.m., and she was scheduled to work the shift alone, which wasn't out of the ordinary. At around 11 p.m., Kelly called her mother Rachel from the gas station to catch up. She mentioned that the station had been busy that night, and they ended the call by saying goodnight and that they'd see each other tomorrow. But no one in the family ever heard from Kelly again. At 2:27 a.m. on what was now June 18th, Kelly made her first of three calls to 911, which connected to the local police station, which was just a few miles away. Now, only the first call has ever been made public. At the request of the family, I'm going to play it for you now.
I'm working the third shift at the Imperial Gas Station. I just had an obscene phone call, and this guy came in earlier, and he was kind of dressed improperly, but I kind of ignored him. I think it was that guy, because he just drove through the parking lot a few seconds before I got the call. You have somebody kind of keep an eye out on me?
Okay, this is on
Main Street.
South Main?
Uh-huh. Over beside McDonald's. Thank you. Bye.
So there you have it. There's the first call. We're going to talk about it right after the break.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app, with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Okay, we're back from break, and you can hear this call. At this point, Kelly doesn't sound overly concerned. I don't know if you could make it out, but it was pretty clear to me what she was saying. She said she was working at the gas station. She had an obscene phone call. There was a guy who came in earlier, and all she said is he was dressed improperly, and she just ignored him. And then she also said that the guy who was improperly dressed had just driven through the parking lot before she got the obscene phone call. So she ends the call by saying, hey, can some people just keep an eye on me? And I bring that up because it's important. I want you guys to pause real quick, whether you're on audio or video, and ask yourself, what does that mean to you? Does her saying that mean to you that she's asking for someone to respond right now and speak with her? Or is she just asking patrol to keep an eye on the area? Maybe drive through the lot a couple times just to make sure everything's okay and maybe serve as a deterrent. I ask you this because this is going to become an important part of the story later. And although Kelly didn't explain what she meant by dressed improperly, detectives later said that they believed the man may have been exposing himself. And unfortunately, this wasn't the first time something like that happened at that gas station. Kelly's older sister Debbie later told the Roanoke Times that inappropriate phone calls and gestures were common when women in the family worked overnight. She said, quote, "We get those all the time." And this may explain why Kelly didn't sound especially alarmed in her first call, but I just gotta say, on a personal note, what are we doing out there? I know this is 40 years ago, but whether it was 40 years ago or yesterday, it's totally unacceptable. Women should be able to work alone on an overnight shift at a gas station without being sexually harassed. I don't understand how guys think they have the right to go in there and speak to a woman like that when she's just trying to earn a living. And I get frustrated now because I know it still happens. You can still see it in different places where, depending on who's working, if it's a woman and she's alone, you'll have these scumbags come in there and they'll look at it as a dating opportunity when in reality, these women are there to get paid. They're there to do a job. Leave them alone, grab what you need, get your gas, and get out of there. They may not act like it because they're trying to be friendly and be good to the customers, but make no mistake about it, you're coming off like a creep and they're probably feeling very uncomfortable. So do us all a favor. And if you're going to try to pick someone up, get on a dating app, do it like everyone else today. Don't try to find the love of your life when she's working somewhere, because if she's working, she's not looking for love at that moment. She's looking for a paycheck. So leave her alone. Do what you got to do. Be on your way. And yes, I have to be honest with you guys. I may be saying this because I have a 12-year-old that's going to be working in a few years, and it scares the shit out of me. But I can tell you this. If she tells me that this is going on, I'll be parked in that parking lot waiting for a shift to end. I can promise you that. And if you know me, my family or friends that are watching right now, you know I am not kidding. But back to Kelly, because after making that initial call, 2 minutes later at 2:29 a.m., she calls 911 again. And this time, she reported that the same suspicious male had returned and now was outside the gas station. She told the dispatcher that he was driving a silver or gray vehicle, possibly a Ford, and she said he had entered the store and was continuing to harass her, again describing him as dressed improperly. At 2:30 a.m., Kelly placed her third and final call to 911, and according to police, this time she sounded frightened and panicked. She said, quote, "Please hurry, he's back." She told the dispatcher that the man had called from the payphone outside and was making obscene comments. Then there was a shuffling noise, and the call abruptly ended. Kelly's mother, Rachel, later listened to the recordings, and she said that she could hear Kelly's fear building with each call, and she was frustrated that the police hadn't responded to the first one. Rachel told the Richmond Times Dispatch, quote, "I felt like they should have been more concerned about her and gone on the first call instead of waiting for the second one. If they had, she would have been saved." She believed that during the second call, Kelly still sounded calm because she assumed help was on the way. Rachel went on to say, quote, "She assumed they would be there in time." The lead detective on the case acknowledged that a quicker response might have changed everything. He said he wished they had recognized how serious the situation was. He added, quote, "You can always hindsight this case. At the time it was a routine call, she wasn't excited." All right, let's break that down, because that's why I asked you that question earlier. On one hand, he is right about something. In hindsight, it's always easy to Monday morning quarterback what someone should do, whether it's in law enforcement or any other job, because you know the outcome. And as far as this specific case is concerned, I have to acknowledge, I don't know what was going on at that particular moment in time for that police department. Were officers all tied up on another call? Was there something going on where they said, okay, we got it and we're going to respond there right after this? I don't know. But for the sake of this conversation and the fact that this detective came out and acknowledged that they made a mistake, I'm going to assume for the sake of this conversation that they weren't tied up and they just chose not to respond because, as he said, she didn't sound excited. Well, if that's the case, it's a problem. She called 911. She didn't call the main line. To me, that's already a problem, because just like today, there's a main phone line and there's 911. Usually, not all the time, there are exceptions. Usually if someone uses 911, it's because it's an urgent matter and they don't have the time or the ability to dial out the whole number. They need you there now. So if the call comes in through 911, that right there should already raise a flag. And also the fact that it's right down the road, you know where the gas station is, you know there's not a lot of traffic over there. You could have some transients coming through the area that aren't from the town. If your police station's right down the road, better to be safe than sorry. If for no other reason than to just be a deterrent, drive by there on the first call. You can tell it's a young girl on the phone. Clearly, she's scared enough to call in the first place. She's probably experienced a lot of this over time and hasn't called in. So if that's going on, get in your cruiser and get your ass over there. If the guy's already gone, great. Maybe the guy who was there will be off in the distance and sees the patrol car pull up, and that'll be enough for them to keep driving down the road. But when you don't go, you run the risk of something like this happening. And I won't lie to you. There were many times during my career where I would think about different cases that we discussed in the academy and just through my own experiences, you know, looking at the news or being on the internet, where you hear about officers who have regret after the fact. And there were times where I would get a call for someone at a gas station or an apartment even, where they would say, oh, sorry, it was a butt dial, or, you know, an accidental call to the wrong number, or, yeah, I heard something, but it's gone now. We still have the ability to respond. And even if I was tired or I was on the other side of the city, if I was free, I usually went by. Not for them, but for me. Because I didn't want to have a situation down the road where I didn't go and I was available, and come to find out that person needed my help and I didn't go. And because I didn't go, something bad happened. I'm naturally an anxious person. So for me, it was to clear my conscience and ensure that I made sure things were okay. I also had some experiences as a kid myself. You don't always have the opportunity to explain what's going on, but I was always hoping the police would show up. So I always went. I know there are times when you're unable to do so. There have been cases where we're all tied up. We're at fights and fires and robberies or whatever it might be, shootings, and you can't get there. So you may have to prioritize and get there later. But if it is what we think it is, and they were just sitting around maybe at the station and they're right down the road and they didn't go, I'd really like to think that even 40 years later, if they're still around, those officers are living with a lot of regret. So at 2:31 a.m., just 1 minute after Kelly's final call to 911, a patrol officer from the Harrisonburg Police Department arrived at the Imperial gas station, and the store was empty. Kelly was gone. Her purse, with money still inside, was sitting on the counter next to a magazine she had been reading, and a partially smoked cigarette rested on the ashtray. There were no signs of struggle, and the cash register hadn't been disturbed, and no money was missing. Based on Kelly's third 911 call and the condition of the scene, the case was immediately classified as an abduction. Detectives estimated that the entire abduction could have taken less than 15 seconds. The distance from the phone Kelly used to call 911 to the door where she was likely taken was only about 10 feet. Detectives theorized that the abductor pulled their vehicle right up to the entrance door, went inside, and forced Kelly out into the car. Both the police and her family believe the person must have been in possession of a weapon, because otherwise, like I said earlier, Kelly was a scrapper and she would have fought back. Police immediately began searching for a silver Ford based on the description Kelly gave in her 911 call, while also keeping an open mind that it was dark outside and Kelly had been viewing the car through the store's front glass. So they couldn't be certain that the description was accurate, but they at least had something to go off of. While the officers were out looking for Kelly and her abductor, her family was told that she was missing. According to WHSV3, when they arrived at the gas station, they were shocked to find that the scene hadn't been secured. There was no police tape, no one was dusting for fingerprints, and customers were still walking in and out as if the store was open for business. So here's where I want to talk about the processing of the scene. Because first off, this is a major problem. Kelly's family was right to be upset. The place should have been taped off, and no one other than law enforcement should have been allowed inside, including Kelly's family. Yes, I know you're going to have a lot of people who have gone in and out of that building throughout the day, throughout the weeks. So you're going to have a lot of evidence or forensics in that establishment, no doubt about it. But no one should be going in and out of that store after this crime occurred, just in case you have something. So let's talk about what they could have potentially had. It was 40 years ago. Forensically, it's not where it is today. But when we talk about the dusting for fingerprints, because that's clearly what Kelly's family was upset about, I'm going to push back a little bit because, as I just said, there are going to be so many sets of fingerprints in there, and a lot of them are going to be smudged or unable to be retrieved based on how much dirt and dust and how many people have touched on top of fingerprints. To put it bluntly, it would be extremely difficult to not only locate prints that may belong to the offender because we don't know what they touched and where they went in the store, but even if you found prints, it would be equally hard to identify who they belong to. And even if you did, think about what you would have to go through, because everybody has a right to be in that store. So regardless of what prints you find, does that serve as incriminating evidence? Only if you can determine that the person who you identify has lied about being there, because then you ask the question, why would they lie? But I have to be reasonable here. Yes, when you watch the movies, you watch TV, you're going to lift fingerprints. You're probably going to find the guy right then and there. Well, one, this was a long time ago, 1982, but even more importantly, even today, it would still be extremely difficult to pull prints in that location that could potentially be used in this case. Now, there are exceptions. I'm not saying I'm the ultimate detective, but there was a case that I had where it was a robbery, and the offender jumped the counter. He was wearing a mask. There was cameras. We could see him jump on the counter, jump over, and then leave the store. And the one thing you wouldn't see on that countertop is a shoe print. Yes, you'd see a lot of fingerprints. That's different. But a shoe print, there's probably only going to be one. So I went in there, and I could see, based on the dust that was on the counter, I could kind of make out the sneaker print. So I had just learned how to do this at the course that I had taken, so I was excited about doing it. And sure enough, I go in there, I dust it, do some little, you know, things we can do to enhance it, and I was able to lift it. And sure enough, not only did we find out who it was, but that print from the sneakers we found on the suspect was a major factor in their conviction. So it's a very rare circumstance, but it can happen. So I don't know about the dusting of fingerprints. I think they could have looked for certain things, but would there be anything usable in there? Probably not. However, that's the fingerprints. One thing they could have used, and one thing they should have seized, and one thing they should have processed either then or now as technology developed would be that cigarette butt. Could it have been Kelly's? I don't know if she smoked or not. Yes, it could have been hers. But if it wasn't, if she didn't smoke and it was still smoldering, smoking, whatever you want to say, it potentially was the offender's. Maybe he was in there for a few minutes on one of the first or second visits when things didn't escalate at that point. And while he was making these obscene gestures towards her, maybe he had a cigarette in his mouth and he put it down. So regardless, that should have been seized and it should have been processed. Now, if someone's DNA came back on that, that could be compelling, because the amount of people that would have left a cigarette behind would have been far and few between. Most people are in and out of there. They complete their transaction and they're on their way. The cigarette, to me, suggests that this person stuck around for a little bit. So again, it's either Kelly or it's our suspect. I don't know what was done with that cigarette butt, but by not securing that scene and allowing people in and out, it contaminates the crime scene and it brings into the equation chain of custody issues. So I do agree with Kelly's family. They should have secured the gas station. They should have processed it as best as they could. They should have seized the cigarette. But as far as the actual fingerprints, they could have tried it. Doesn't hurt to try. But I don't have a lot of hope for what the results would have revealed. Just want to be honest with you guys and set expectations, not only for this case, but as we move forward and talk about other cases, and I may bring this up. So when Kelly's family walks into the store, Rachel asked why the scene hadn't been secured, and the police were dismissive, and according to the family, they were outright rude. Later, detectives said that they didn't attempt to collect fingerprints because, in their view, there would have been too many to process. And after all, it was a gas station, which I just acknowledged is probably true and accurate. But I didn't hear any mention about the cigarette butt, so as I sit here right now, I still want to know what happened to it. Was that collected? Do they have it in evidence? Has it been processed? These are questions we need answered. So while this is going on at the gas station, detectives canvassed the area surrounding the Imperial gas station and spoke with employees at nearby businesses. They also interviewed customers who had stopped at the station before Kelly was abducted. Through those conversations, they determined that 2:15 a.m. was the last time anyone reported seeing Kelly, and they knew that she had made her first call to 911 just 12 minutes later, which meant that the abductor had arrived sometime between that short window. One employee at a nearby Hoppin convenience store further told police that he had seen a man driving a two-tone silver car in the area several times that night. According to him, the vehicle had passed by the store about three times, and the last time he saw it was roughly a half hour before Kelly disappeared. He described the driver as a thin white male, around 20 to 25 years old, with shoulder-length blonde hair and a light-colored shirt. That same employee also reported that about 2 weeks earlier, a man driving a silver car had exposed himself to a female coworker. So, as I said earlier, this was unfortunately a common occurrence for female workers, which is totally unacceptable. But this particular event that this employee reported is relevant when you consider what Kelly had reported right before her disappearance. So, based on the description that was provided to law enforcement, they created a composite sketch of the man with blonde hair and they passed it out to the public. But as officers later acknowledged, the sketch wasn't especially helpful. Realistically, it could have matched half the male student population at James Madison University. And when you look at the sketch, if you're watching on YouTube right now, you can see it. If we're looking at it and we're being honest, it's pretty vague and it probably matches a lot of people. So that is unfortunate. I'm still glad they did it, but I could see how they probably had a lot of people come in. And depending on who the officer is or who the detective is, probably matched a lot of people. So that's not going to help you too much. So as the investigation unfolded, Kelly's family, including her husband Dale, launched their own search efforts. They scoured the area, spoke to the media, and did everything they could to raise awareness. Meanwhile, detectives continued their investigation, interviewing potential witnesses and possible suspects. And because Dale was Kelly's husband, he was questioned several times, but detectives never found anything that linked him to her disappearance. And I would imagine that if there was anything at this point, anything at all, that discredited where he was that evening, we would know about it. So I'm assuming based on what we have here, 40 years later, they probably had some verifiable information that ruled Dale out completely. Eventually, detectives came to believe that Kelly wasn't specifically targeted. Instead, they think her abduction was a crime of opportunity, committed by someone who realized a woman was working alone at an isolated gas station in the middle of the night. And I completely agree. I don't know if this individual had this plan going into the evening, but when he saw Kelly working alone, maybe he had thought about this before. Maybe he had fixated on Kelly at the gas station in the past. And when the circumstances aligned, Kelly working the overnight shift, maybe it wasn't that busy at that point, again, at a gas station in the middle of the night, that's when he decided to take advantage of it. So yes, that would be the definition of a crime of opportunity. So I do agree with law enforcement. I don't think it was premeditated. I think initially this guy went there for some gas or to get a pack of cigarettes. And when he saw Kelly alone, his intentions changed. By late July, 6 weeks had passed since Kelly was abducted. Around that time, Lead Detective Lieutenant Hubert Myers sat down with the Roanoke Times to discuss the investigation. He said police had followed every lead they received. Much of the focus had been on the men with histories of sex crimes or reports of unusual sexual behavior. Myers also revealed that detectives believed the abduction may have been sexually motivated, especially considering the number of obscene phone calls the Imperial gas station had received in the weeks leading up to Kelly's disappearance. Since the incident, the station had only received one, which that checks out, right? If you have this person who's making these obscene phone calls leading up to this event, the situation's escalating before they act, and then finally they abduct Kelly. Well, after the fact, they're going to go off the radar. And that appears to be what happened here. It also tells me that more than likely, the majority of those phone calls came from our suspect. Myers said that he was frustrated by the lack of answers, but he wasn't giving up. He told the Roanoke Times, quote, "We're not about to throw in the towel. In 31 years with the Harrisonburg Police Department, this is probably the most challenging thing I've ever got into. Sooner or later, we're going to get a break on it. We will find that woman." Now, as a side note, I will say Kelly's family wasn't completely thrilled with this statement. They didn't like the fact that he referred to her as that woman. And I can't imagine what they're going through, and I can understand their frustration there. He could have chosen his words better. He could have said her name. He could have said, "We will find Kelly." Do I think there was any malice behind it? No. I don't know how often Myers is speaking to the media. He's been on the job 31 years, so I'm sure it's not his first time, but I understand where they're coming from, and I'm not going to discredit their feelings. This is personal to them. And that's what I'm always trying to drive home with these cases. These are stories, but they're real people. They're not fictional characters. So every single word, even the way I describe things, there's somebody watching, there's somebody listening, and there's family members of these victims who are paying attention to what I say and how I say it, and that's not lost on me. So I understand where they're coming from. Speaking of which, this is a perfect time to mention that Kelly's sister, Elaine, actually worked with us on the development of this episode. So clearly she's listening, she's watching, but my delivery matters as well. So I hope up to this point, Elaine, I'm doing a good job. Thank you for allowing me to cover your sister's case. So after Myers made his comments, Dale also spoke to the Roanoke Times, and he said, quote, "There's no way she would have gone off on her own. Not with money and cigarettes there and the magazine open and her little girl." So when you break that down, what I take away from it, and this could be an indication that the cigarette was hers. This was the one thing I saw where I was like, you know, it's 50-50, but you still got to do it. He does mention cigarettes here. So there's money there that's hers. We know that's hers. The cigarettes are potentially hers. And then, you know, her little girl at home, her daughter waiting for her, who we have already mentioned. She loved being a mom. She was obsessed with her daughter. She would never have left her behind. And I will say one more thing about the cigarettes, because I'm not off of that yet. She could have been a cigarette smoker. She may have had cigarettes on her. It still doesn't 100% guarantee that that burning cigarette in the ashtray belonged to her. So I stand by what I said. That cigarette should be in custody. In January of 1983, Lieutenant Myers sat down with the Richmond Times Dispatch and shared more details. He acknowledged that early in the case, they had broadened their horizons and considered the possibility that Kelly had left on her own. But the deeper they looked into her life, her close relationship with her family, and her devotion to her five-year-old daughter, the less that theory made sense. Meyer spoke honestly and said, quote, "Since we got no leads that she was alive, since she was a family woman, she's dead, and she's buried within 50 miles. I appreciate the honesty. Probably not needed, not going to help the case. It could be true, but he has no proof of that. He has no proof that she's buried within 50 miles and that she's dead. You need evidence to support that. So I don't like the approach. I don't like the delivery. And based on the phrasing, without knowing Lieutenant Myers, it seems like maybe he's not the appropriate guy to maybe be doing the media interviews. He clearly is not media trained. And although then it was a different time, but I don't necessarily like what he said here. I don't think it needed to be said. I haven't talked to Kelly's family about how they feel about it, but I can only imagine if I'm a family member, this is not what I want to hear from the people in charge of bringing my loved one home. Because if they've lost hope, how much are they really looking into it? So regardless of what you think as a detective, there are certain things that don't need to be said. Myers ended his interview by saying that they had repeatedly searched the area and the FBI had also gotten involved, but there was still no sign of Kelly. Kelly's mom, Rachel, also spoke to the dispatch saying that she wanted to believe her daughter was alive, but that hope was growing harder to hold on to. She told the paper, quote, "When I'm driving to work in the morning, I think, do I pass her body every day?" It's an impactful statement. Why? Because it's a real fear of hers. She has to live with that every single day. And the sad reality is it could be true. And that's what makes it so terrible. As a parent, I can't imagine. As you're trying to live your life, knowing that your child is somewhere out there, knowing that this nightmare is a real possibility. I say it all the time. I've been saying it for almost 2 years. I don't know how these parents do it. I'd like to think I'd be as strong as them, but I have a feeling I'd be balled up in the corner. Truthfully, I was balled up in the corner for 2 weeks after my dog passed away. I was struggling. You wouldn't think that, but it's the truth. So when I hear these stories and I think about what these parents have to endure and how they continue to fight, it's so inspirational. It really is. And just this comment, I've never heard it said like this. And when I read it for the first time, I just kind of sat there for a second because it's like, wow, that's a real truth. That's a real fear that she has to live with every day. It's terrible. Now, here's where we start to get a little good news in the story, because Rachel and the rest of Kelly's family were always on the lookout for the suspect's car. How could you not be, right? And one day, Rachel spotted a car parked on the street that matched the description of the vehicle Kelly had mentioned in her 911 call. She immediately contacted the police, who then asked the owner for permission to search it, and they agreed. So the detectives vacuumed the trunk of the vehicle and placed whatever they collected into evidence. Now, at the time this occurred, they didn't have the technology to test it, but that evidence will come up later. But after the search, without really having a way to do anything with what was collected, the investigation continued, and despite following dozens of leads and interviewing multiple people of interest, police never identified the person responsible, and the case eventually went cold. In 1989, 8 years after she disappeared, Kelly was officially declared dead. Years went by without any new reporting on the investigation, and Kelly's case sat on a shelf, completely untouched. But her family never stopped searching for her, hoping one day they'd have answers. In 2020, 38 years after Kelly disappeared, Elaine met Virginia delegate Tony Will at a polling station. She asked him how to go about getting a bill passed, explaining that she wanted legislation to prohibit people from working alone in 24-hour convenience stores. That conversation led to her sharing Kelly's story, a case Delegate Wilt was already familiar with. But he was shocked to learn that nothing had ever been done and that no one was actively helping the family. The very next day, Elaine received a call from the Harrisonburg Police Department. They told her they were going to reopen Kelly's case. Her family was beyond thankful. I'll tell you, that's the way you get something done. You got to get to these political figures, and I've said it multiple times. If you can't apply pressure to the police department, you got to get the person above them, whether that's the mayor or it's a congressman or some delegate or a senator. You get up to the top, trust me, shit rolls downhill. People want to stay in the positions they're in. A lot of this revolves around elections. So you get to the right person who has a passion, all it takes is one phone call. And that's what happened here. So the case was officially reopened, and Detective Brooke Weatherell of the Major Crimes Unit was assigned as the lead. And I'm happy to report that, according to the family, Detective Weatherell took Kelly's case seriously from the start and has continued to carry it with her in the department even after being promoted. And you do see that sometimes where you have someone who's invested, they're already in the Major Crimes Unit, she's probably high in the ranks now, so she has the ability to say, hey, this one's staying with me and I'm happy to see it. And once the case was reopened, police sent off the evidence that had been vacuumed from the trunk of the car Rachel had spotted years earlier, the one that had potentially matched the description Kelly had given during her 911 call. The family also learned something they hadn't known before. When the original detective searched the vehicle, they actually found the print of a tennis shoe in the carpet of the trunk. And this print actually matched the shoe size Kelly wore. However, it's important to note, it's unknown whether Kelly was wearing tennis shoes at the time she disappeared. And as far as the evidence that was vacuumed from the trunk and sent off for testing, Elaine isn't sure of those results yet because the testing hasn't come back. So we may not know for a little while. If something does come back that's positive, investigators have to do what they have to do. But as we sit here right now, those results are still pending. I also want to mention, because I think it's great that it was done, and it's not always the case, that in addition to sending off that evidence to be tested, Detective Weatherell re-interviewed every former suspect in the case, and according to the department, this step proved to be critical because they were able to eliminate every person with the exception of one. We're going to talk about that person right after this break.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Okay, we're back. Let's talk about this person that law enforcement was unable to rule out. So, according to Elaine, the remaining suspect is a man that Kelly went to high school with. His name has never been made public, but she said that he has a criminal record that includes indecent exposure and making obscene phone calls. In addition to that, he also matches the composite sketch and has previously owned a car that fits the description Kelly gave during her 911 call. So, not a slam dunk, but a lot of information that points in the right direction. And Elaine wanted to make it very clear that Kelly did not know this man. More than likely, she didn't even recognize him when she saw him outside the gas station. And that's because after Kelly had Tammy and she got married, as I said earlier, she mostly kept to herself. She would go to school and then she would go straight home to Dale and Tammy. She didn't spend a lot of time socializing with kids her own age. That's just the way she operated. And it gets even more compelling with this guy because at one point after Detective Weatherell privately identified this man as a suspect, the Harrisonburg Crime Solvers, a local nonprofit, received an anonymous letter that mentioned the suspect by name. Now that detail stood out immediately because, as I just mentioned, this man has never been publicly identified. Detective Weatherell responded to the letter hoping for more information, but she never heard back. She still hopes the person who sent it will come forward and may have the key to making an arrest. As of now, the suspect has not been named and no arrests have been made. Kelly is still missing, but her family hopes that justice is right around the corner. All right, let's dive into this perspective. I want to talk about some of the things I mentioned earlier, elaborate on some of the information I relayed, and also talk about where we go from here. So to start, I agree with law enforcement's assessment, even the family's assessment, that most likely the individual involved with this came back to the gas station and brandished a weapon. I think that's the only reason why Kelly would go without a fight. He steps out of the car, just like law enforcement said. He's got a knife or a gun. Kelly feels like she has no other choice, and she goes with him. That's the only reason I think she would go without a struggle. And as we heard from the 911 call, there was kind of a shuffling of the phone. She really went without saying anything, and that was the end of it. So to me, that does suggest that more than likely she was probably caught off guard, maybe frozen by what she was seeing. And before she could kind of process it, she just went with whatever she was being directed to do. I also want to elaborate on the vehicle that was identified by Rachel, the one with the trunk, where they vacuumed the evidence and they also located that tennis shoe print. I know my people that have been with me a long time, my part-time detectives, you're in the comments right now, or if you're in the car, you're yelling at your radio saying, Derek, is the owner of that vehicle also the high school acquaintance? If you are asking that question, great job. Because I was asking the same question and I followed up with Haley. As of right now, as I sit here and talk to you, we don't know. It's possible they're not connected. They could be two different leads. The vehicle could belong to the owner, and this high school acquaintance could be a completely different suspect that has no connection to the car. We got to follow up on that and see what the case is there. But I will say this. If for some reason something processed from that vehicle turns up to be connected to Kelly, it's very possible if it's not the same person, then that means the high school acquaintance isn't our guy, and we have to look at the owner. I'll also say this. If there's something in there, they got to reverse engineer it. They got to make sure that the owner of that vehicle now is the same person who had it at the time of the incident. Did he let anybody borrow it? And is there anybody else we need to look into before coming to any conclusion? So the vehicle and the high school guy may not be the same person or may not be the same connection there. It could be two different leads that need to be followed. I just want to make that distinction clear. Now, if it turns out that the high school acquaintance is also the owner of that vehicle, I think we might have our guy. I think we might be onto something there, but I don't know. I don't know if that's the case. So moving on from that, where do we go from here? There's a few things that we need to do that we should be doing. And this is with any cold case. If you have potential suspects, and I know a lot of them are already vetted, you want to look at their criminal history and any recorded incidents with them before the incident and also after the incident. 40 years is a lot of data. Any people that you were looking into or any new people that have come up on your list, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. We want to look what they were involved in before Kelly disappeared, and then years later, did they reoffend? These are people that we have to follow up with to see if they have a similar MO. Did they do anything at a gas station or with a girlfriend or a wife that's similar to what we're looking at here as far as pattern of behavior? If there is, we need to add them to the list. That's very important. I would also say, without knowing the extent of registration recordings at the time when this occurred in 1982, whether it's a paper file or now it's digitized, we also need to go in there and see if we can search for vehicles that match the possible description. This has happened before in a more recent case, Long Island serial killer. And although there was a more specific description of a vehicle there that was an Avalanche and there wasn't as many of them, doesn't matter. Regardless of how difficult the task may be, if there's something that can be explored, we need to do it. So I would go back and see what vehicles were registered in 1982 that matched the description and see who the owners were at that time and see if there's any correlation to the potential suspects we have currently on our list. If there's anything that intersects over a specific person, that's someone we need to take a deeper look at. And finally, and probably most importantly, we need anyone with information to come forward. As I said, the family and law enforcement believe that this person might be the guy. And when we think about the letter and him being named, there's someone out there who has information that can help us. And we need them to come forward because according to the people that we've spoke with, law enforcement might be close to making an arrest. They're just looking for that last piece of the puzzle. And someone out there who's listening to this or watching this right now, you may be that person and you know if you are. Please, please come forward. Not only for Kelly, but for her family that's still here living with this nightmare every single day. So, if that's you or anybody else for that matter, I want to recap the story real quick so we have all the information. Kelly Bergdove was 20 years old when she went missing on June 18th, 1982. She was last seen working the overnight shift at the Imperial gas station on South Main Street in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Kelly was 5'1" tall and weighed between 100 and 120 pounds. She had brown hair, brown eyes, and wore both contact lenses and glasses. She had a partial dental plate that replaced her two front teeth, a scar on the back of her head, and one along her hairline and another one on her right wrist. At the time of her disappearance, Kelly was wearing a light-colored pinstripe sweater or top along with tan or cream-colored slacks. She also wore her high school class ring, and the ring had the initials KJB engraved on the inside. The man believed to be responsible for her disappearance was described as a thin white male between 20 and 25 years old with shoulder-length blonde hair and a light-colored shirt. He was last seen driving a silver or gray vehicle, possibly a Ford. Anyone with information about Kelly's case should contact Detective Weatherell at 540-432-7788, and those who wish to remain anonymous can also call Crime Solvers at 540-574-5050. If you don't have information but you are interested in helping Kelly's family, please share this episode along with Kelly's flyer, which you'll see on the screen right here. My final words, as always, go out to Kelly's friends and family, specifically Elaine, for not only helping us develop this episode, but also entrusting me to tell your sister's story. I really think we're right at the finish line. We just need a little bit more information, and I'm hoping that I'm back here very soon letting all of you know that there's been an arrest in Kelly's case. Until then, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you next week.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.